So let me begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me as Experimentalist of the Week. One goal of mine coming here is to understand by the end of my visit what the heck a material is. but another goal is just to tell you about some of the research my group has been doing and in this talk today, and hopefully this will lead to further discussion over the next few days. And I have three different topics, and they're nicely divided in different dimensions as well. I'll talk about a one-dimensional system we've been studying composed of spin a half chains, and it's kind of frustrated in the sense you'll see that they have staggered chains, so the dimerization is frustrated, and a new thing that we see is a soft phonon in a spin parallel system. I'll move on to two dimensions in these Kagome lattice materials that many of you are familiar with. We've studied both classical and a quantum Kagome lattice system. And then I'll move on very briefly, I might run out of time, on a three-dimensional pyrochlore system that we just began studying in single crystal form. And this work couldn't be done without a bunch of collaborators. So I'll just list a whole bunch. Kit Matan, Joel Halton, and Eric Abel were my grad students who did most of the neutron and X-ray scattering work. You need good samples, and we grew some in my group with the assistance of Fong Chu and Xiaoyan Chu. And I collaborate with the chemistry group who makes very nice Kagome lattice materials. Dan Nocera is the professor of that group. And we do neutron scattering at NIST and Oak Ridge. We've done low temperature susceptibility and specific heat measurements at the National High Magnetic Field Lab, and we did X-ray scattering measurements at Argonne National Lab. So let me begin with the first system. And it's an interesting system. It's titanium oxychloride, and we think it's a good spin one-half spin chain material, and you can grow single crystals of this. Here's the basic structure. One thing that's nice is that it's a fairly simple structure, as you can see. So it's essentially made up of these titanium oxide bilayers that are weakly coupled. There's a chlorine layer in between them, and it cleaves very easily. So at least it's a very two-dimensional system, but you can also think about how the orbitals are arranged, and I'll just talk about that in the next slide. So the titanium metal is the magnetic ion. It has one electron in a d orbital, so you would expect to spin one half. And if you just look at the titaniums themselves and project them onto the plane from above, you do have this kind of square lattice arrangement. But again, the arrangement of the orbitals will matter in discussing the physics. And so it appears that this is a good one-dimensional system, in fact. And there are possible orderings that you might expect from the d orbitals for titanium. And one would be if you had the dxy orbitals just aligned along the b direction, and then you'll have direct overlap between the orbitals. And another possibility is having these kind of zigzag chains. And there was some early work by Patrick Lee and collaborators where they performed LDA plus U calculations and showed that this arrangement of linear chains along the B direction was favored. So if that's the case, and here's another view of that, you do have this direct overlap. What you have are chains, but they're perfectly staggered. So you have this chain of titaniums, and then staggered by half a lattice spacing, you have the neighboring chain. And that's quite nice. If you had to design a system to study spin parallels physics, well, what would you like would be have spin a half chains with no coupling in between. But in reality, it's very hard to have. So if you can just have perfectly staggered chains, that really frustrates the coupling between them. So this is a very good way of trying to get a spin parallel system.
Well, then the chains live in plane.
Yeah, so this chain is in a different different position along the C-axis than the neighboring chain.
Remember, the chains, the strongest coupling, the chains that are closest to a given chain form a plane, do they?
So here's how it looks like. So you have one chain here, you have another chain below.
Okay.
Something like that.
Yeah, those are planes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there are some early measurements of the magnetic susceptibility measured up to high temperatures, and they can fit the high temperature susceptibility to the Bonner-Fisher curve for a spin and a half system, and it fits fairly well. So this looks like you do have a pretty good realization of a one-dimensional Heisenberg spin chain. You can extract J, that's the only fit parameter here, and they get something on the order of 57 millivolts. Lemons and co-workers did Raman scattering studies, and they see some 2 magnon Raman peak, and they extracted J consistent with the susceptibility result. So it looks like it's probably a good one-dimensional Heisenberg system. So we've done some thermodynamic measurements on single crystal samples, and this was recently put out in preprint form on CONMAT. And there's also been work by a big German group at different universities, Cologne, Bayreuth, and Augsburg as well. And in the single crystals, there are several things that I want to point out. One is that here's the susceptibility measured along the 3 different crystal axes. And at low temperatures, there's a drop in the susceptibility, and it's about the same drop along the different crystal axes. And that's what you would expect if you had singlet formation rather than like nail order at some low temperature. So we believe there might be a singlet ground state in this system. And if you look at this carefully, there are 2 kind of kinks in the susceptibility, one around this higher temperature, 92 Kelvin, and one around a lower temperature, roughly 66 Kelvin. And this lower temperature transition is hysteretic, depending if you're cooling or warming. Here's a derivative of the susceptibility, and you can see that there is a hysteresis in temperature. So it looks like this is a first order transition. I also plotted the specific heat. You do see anomalies at both transitions. And this temperature of 92 Kelvin is more gradual, and it looks like that's a second order transition. So what happens at these transitions? Well, if we think we have a spin parallel system, you expect at low temperatures to have a dimerization of the lattice, and you could see that with X-ray diffraction. And in fact, we see below this 66 Kelvin temperature that we do have an extra super lattice peak that appears. So we can see that there's this clear peak at 30 Kelvin that's not there at 67 Kelvin that corresponds to doubling of the lattice along the B direction. So again, these assumptions that we had linear change along the B direction are confirmed by seeing a dimerization along that direction. And if we look at the temperature dependence of the intensity of the super lattice peak, we see that you have this high intensity and it drops very sharply at this transition temperature. And also it's hysteretic on warming and cooling. So the dimerization also shows that it's first order in nature at that temperature.
But you said previously that this was second order at the 66.
Oh, sorry. No, it was second order at the higher temperature. And I'll talk about that later. Second order at the 92 Kelvin temperature, first order at 66. So it looks like it's spin parallels like, but it's not exactly what we expect. Why is it first order? And there was this other temperature at higher, at 92 Kelvin, what happens there? So what's the difference in this system? Well, I think something that's important is that you do have these staggered spin chains. So when you try to dimerize the lattice, it's kind of frustrated. So very simply is, you can imagine having chains that are not staggered. So if you dimerize one pair on the chain, then obviously you'd like to dimerize the neighboring chain in the same way. So that's not frustrated. If they're staggered, you dimerize one chain, then there are 2 ways of dimerizing the neighbor. I could dimerize this way or dimerize this way. That's essentially what's happening. And here's just another way of looking at it. You can dimerize the different chains. I could just label them A and B. And if I dimerize B in this particular pattern, I can dimerize the A chain this way, or I can dimerize it another way shown in gray, A prime. And they're both equivalent. So that is due to the staggered nature of these chains. The frustration of the lattice interactions. Yeah. So this is a very simplified view if you're just looking at the titanium atoms. Right? There are oxygen movements and chlorine movements, and that would be much more complicated. But just to take a big picture view.
From a symmetry viewpoint, is it still equivalent ways?
What do you mean by that question?
A and A prime, mm-hmm. would be equivalent to the symmetry viewpoint.
I believe so. I mean, energetically, they're degenerate. So if you just had B A prime B A prime B A prime, that's equivalent to B A B A B A, I would say. Yeah.
But
that's right. You could have many different ways of doing it. Then that would not be necessarily equivalent. Yeah. And there's another thing. Once you choose to dimerize the two chains, you can shift the center of mass of one chain with respect to the other chain. There's no symmetry reason preventing that from happening. And that shift parameter we can call tau.
Is there an estimate of the interchain coupling?
Magnetic? I don't think it's quite clear. There's some work by a German group in photo emission, and they do have some estimates. And I can't tell you offhand what that is. So a consequence of this frustration, we believe this leads to having a structural distortion between these two transition temperatures that is incommensurate. And you can actually see that with X-ray scattering. So again, below TC1, you have this commensurate dimerization. Below this higher temperature, you have some incommensurate modulation of the lattice. So at low temperatures, you see this peak at a commensurate position, and then at intermediate temperatures, you see two incommensurate peaks. So what's happening is that as you go down to this 66 Kelvin transition, you have an incommensurate to commensurate transition, and that is the first order transition. Below this 92 Kelvin transition, you have this smooth onset of the incommensurate superlattice peaks, and here's intensity shown here. And we can measure the incommensurate wave vector. It has two components along the two in-plane directions, H and K, and that wave vector varies smoothly as you cool down in temperature. And again, you know, we can talk more about some of the details after this talk if you're interested. Just let me give you the basic picture of what we think is happening. So we do have a model for the incommensurate phase as we cool down below 92 Kelvin. And here's some of our data. This is in reciprocal space map. We show the intensities. So in the center here, if you had just the commensurate dimerization, you would have a single peak in the center. But we see in the incommensurate phase four peaks surrounding that center position. And actually, we see some additional scattering out here, which we attribute to third harmonic scattering. And so how do we describe the structure given by the X-ray data? Well, again, if you just had a dimerized structure, you'll have a single peak in the center. If you now take that chain that's dimerized and make it slightly an incommensurate wave vector, instead of having a doubling of the unit cell, something that's 2.04 times the unit cell, you will split that commensurate peak. And in order to get the pattern that we see here, all we do now is take neighboring chains and slightly shift the phases of the dimerization on neighboring chains. And that's what we're trying to show here in this cartoon. And when you shift the phases of the neighboring chains in the direction perpendicular to the chains, you now rotate the incommensurate wave vector along some diagonal line, such as this. And that type of scattering gives us the peaks along this diagonal line. To get all four peaks that we show here, we need to have two types of domains. So you essentially have a one-dimensional incommensurate modulation given by this cartoon, and then two domains of that, which we just see. We see the average in the X-ray scattering measurement. And you know, this may not be very helpful. You know, if you can stare at this for an hour, I think you'll see some information in it. When I stare at this, you know, you can actually see that there are these long domains, these kind of long stripes that are slightly slanted, and each domain corresponds to a different tau shift of neighboring chains. And in between the two domains, you have a phase boundary, and that domain wall corresponds to atoms which are almost undimerized, and we call them the solitons. So you have domain walls of solitons, and along this direction, perpendicular to those stripes, is the one-dimensional lattice modulation.
Wait, the atoms that are almost undimerized are almost free moments or not?
So there might be, yeah, a free moment, and I mean that's consistent with the susceptibility. So here's the temperature between 90 Kelvin and 65 Kelvin is this incommensurate phase, and the susceptibility has not gone down to its lowest value. So you still have a free moment that we do see in the susceptibility. When the soliton lattice disappears and you have a completely dimerized structure, then that's where you just see this flat susceptibility, which we think is the singlet ground state.
So you're trying to turn up a little bit. In a completely free moment, the susceptibility would start going up, otherwise it's cut off by the second transition.
But as you keep cooling, you're losing, I mean, the density of solitons decreases as you cool down.
So the ground state would have none. Is that what you're,
the ground state would have none, correct. The ground state has no more solitons. So the spacing between the solitons increases and eventually diverges.
Normally excited.
Yeah.
Is the data corrected for impurities?
Yeah, sorry. This data is corrected for impurities. So there is a small, I think it's less than 1% impurity, yeah, that's been subtracted out.
Does it cool down to the intermediate phase? Does the wave vector
towards
the commensurate value?
Yes, it does. So both of these wave vectors go to this commensurate position. Okay.
So there's also length scale in there.
Mm-hmm. And I can talk a little bit about that as well. If you analyze the intensity of the higher harmonics to the first harmonic, you get some sense for the width of the solitons, right? And we've done that analysis. And here is the ratio of the third harmonic intensity to the first harmonic. This red line corresponds to a fixed soliton width of 5 angstroms. So that would be a very narrow soliton width. So we see that there is a range of temperatures where this seems to follow a fixed soliton width. But at these wave vectors here, and these are temperatures right below 92 Kelvin, it falls off that line. So I think what we have is, as soon as you go below 92 Kelvin, you have more or less sinusoidal incommensurate modulation of the lattice. And as you cool further, it becomes more soliton-like. Yeah, or even a higher temperature. There's a pseudo gap at maybe 150 Kelvin. I don't know. I don't understand the pseudo gap. Yeah, so I can't comment too much about that. No. Okay. I would love to hear more about that. Okay. So, you know, why study titanium oxide chloride as a spin pyrrole system? It's one thing is it's a second inorganic example of a spin pyrrole system. Another thing is the first inorganic example of a spin pyrrole system might not be a really good spin pyrrole system. You know, it's an interesting material, copper germanate, but there are several things that make it kind of funny in a spin pyrrole sense. The Bonner-Fischer form does not fit the susceptibility very well, and Riera and co-workers estimate that there is a next nearest neighbor along the chain that's significant. And if you had a next nearest neighbor of 0.241, you expect dimerization even without the spin pyrrole mechanism. So this might not be a spin pyrrole system if J prime really is that large. There's been neutron results by Reynaud and co-workers, so there's significant magnetic dispersion perpendicular to the chain. That's about at the 10% level for J interchain, and this is not frustrated, so you do have a stronger coupling of the two chains. And one puzzling thing is that you expect the dimerization transition to also correspond to a soft phonon transition. And studied in copper germanate, a soft phonon has never been found. So we went to study the phonon dynamics in titanium oxychloride.
Wait just a second. So if J prime is bigger than J, bringing that point to
yes.
Whatever, even in a model where there is no phonon, but
it would still dimerize. That's correct. You don't need coupling to the lattice to dimerize. You will dimerize for magnetic reasons, and then that would, parasitically distort the lattice.
But I think in soft phonons, that is something people really good at, if you just do the if you start from a very low frequency, it's often. And if you start from a very high
frequency,
so that's just for the near same behind the model?
There is some understanding of why this might not be seen in copper germanate. There's a large phonon frequency relative to the magnetic energy scale. And in titanium oxychloride, we have a very large magnetic energy scale. So you might have the possibility of seeing a soft phonon. And we perform measurements. Normally, you use neutron scattering to look at phonons, but these crystals that we have are very small. They're tens of microns thick. So what we used was a technique that you might not be as familiar with. It's inelastic X-ray scattering, but with very high energy resolution. And here's just a picture of the beamline. This was done at the Advanced Photon Source. And essentially, if you can backscatter a photon, you can just pick a narrow bandwidth with high energy resolution. So you use a high energy resolution monochromator, you scatter from your sample, and the detector is placed almost near the sample position. So you're hitting an analyzer and scattering almost exactly backwards. And when you do that, you can get very good energy resolution, about 2 millivolts. With regular X-ray diffraction, you might have one EV energy resolution. So backscattering can reduce that considerably. But of course, you're throwing away a lot of photons in the process, 10 to the 9 photons. For a neutron scatterer, these numbers are very familiar to us. We do get MeV energy resolutions in that many neutrons per second on the sample. So it looks just like neutron scattering. But now you can do this because the X-ray beam is very small, hundreds of microns. You can scatter from small samples. So this is great for phonon studies, and probably in the future when we make interesting samples, but they might be very small crystals, inelastic X-ray scattering will probably become more and more important.
Well, you need to get rid of absorption if you have to have heavy elements.
Yeah, that could be. So each
light elements in here, so you can.
That's right. Each system has its own problems, and for magnetic inelastic scattering, you will always want to use neutrons, I think, because the magnetic cross-section for X-rays is very small. Okay, so we used this to measure the phonons, and we concentrated on the longitudinally polarized phonons along the chain direction. Here's some of our raw data at different temperatures, and we'll just focus on the summary here.
Sorry, can I ask, what are the energies of the photons?
The photons are like 40 keV photons. About an angstrom. Yeah.
Okay.
So we've measured the different phonon modes. In the longitudinal direction, we see some optic modes. We see this longitudinal acoustic mode. And one thing that we notice is that we just use a simple lattice dynamical calculation, and that fits the optic modes quite nicely. But it does not describe this longitudinal acoustic mode very well. So this longitudinal acoustic mode is soft compared to the calculation. The calculation expects it to have around 25 millivolt zone boundary energy, and it goes up to maybe about 15 millivolts at most. Another thing is looking at the width, gamma shown here for the longitudinal acoustic phonon, we see that the width increases considerably as you go out to the zone boundary. And the zone boundary is the dimerization wave vector as well. So this phonon line width, it's also the inverse lifetime for the phonon, gets anomalously broadened at the zone boundary. And just describing this quantitatively is something that I would love to be able to have some ideas for. Just phenomenologically, we can fit our data with damped harmonic oscillator cross-section. And we can get the phonon frequency and line width from the fits. And one thing we can plot, and it just can take my word for it for now, that this quantity, the temperature divided by the intensity of the phonons that we measure, is proportional to omega naught squared, the phonon frequency. And in mean field theory, and this has been studied a lot in displacement phase transitions, that should be proportional to T minus TC. And when we do that, we see that we do have roughly linear behavior close to the transition temperature, and you would expect a transition temperature around 90 Kelvin. Independently, we can plot omega naught squared divided by gamma, and again, we can see this is on a log scale, that this thing starts to plummet below 100 Kelvin, roughly 90 Kelvin is where we expect a softening of the phonon. So this is the first observation of a soft phonon in a spin pyrrole system. Hasn't been seen in copper germinate, and there's a lot of organic spin pyrrole systems, but you don't have the lattice dynamical measurements of those systems. So that was kind of interesting and fun for us to make that measurement.
This is the phonon that corresponds to the distortion that you observe.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So this is, for the titanium atoms, you can imagine the longitudinal phonon mode, and that freezes in at a wave vector that corresponds to the dimerization.
For the staggered dimers, it somehow means that there's some wave vector in the other direction in which the phonon mm-hmm. is.
So, yeah, we've only concentrated on this, the line along the chain direction. You know, we need to do more studies of the other phonon modes. And another thing that we can do, and many of you are familiar with the famous Cross-Fisher theory for spin pyrrole systems, which has a soft phonon mode. And they take into account of the spin phonon coupling. They treat the phonon system in a mean field way, but they calculate the spin dynamics in a more exact manner. And they can calculate the polarizability, or the phonon self-energy. And you know that their function has not really been tested quantitatively because of lack of data, and we tried to analyze our results in terms of their theory. So here's just some raw data at the zone boundary position at different temperatures, and the line through the data is the Cross-Fisher polarizability, and it seems to fit fairly well. This is again for the zone boundary phonon. We can also fit the phonons away from the zone boundary and plot as a function of Q, the bare phonon frequency. And when we plot that data, it matches much better this lattice dynamical calculation. So you need to take into account the spin phonon coupling in order to compare well with the lattice dynamical calculation. Here is omega naught. This is sometimes called the quasi-harmonic frequency. This is the frequency that should soften at the transition, and we can see that it does soften. So the Cross-Fisher theory captures some aspects of the data that we have. There are problems, however, for some data that is taken at temperatures that are far above the spin pyrrole's temperature, and for Q vectors that are away from the zone boundary. And this is where the theory should not be as accurate. And some hints that this doesn't work is that the J value that we get when we fit the phonon line widths away from the zone boundary is about 200 Kelvin. That's three times smaller than what was estimated from the susceptibility. But at the same time, I find this quite remarkable that just by measuring phonon line widths, we can get an estimate of J that's within a factor of three. I find that kind of interesting. And also, we find that there's a temperature-dependent spin phonon coupling. So here's the spin phonon coupling we extract from our data, and it does change with temperature in order to get these phonon line widths correct. And we don't expect it to change with temperature. So again, there should be ways to quantitatively improve our understanding of this.
Yep. The zone boundary phonon, is it Raman active?
I don't believe it's been seen. The optic modes at the zone boundary, yes, have been seen, and they're consistent with calculations. The longitudinal zone boundary mode, I don't believe has been seen.
Yeah, but it's very high energy Raman. I mean, just a 1 eV Raman, mm-hmm. much simpler experiment, which you could do, and where you should see the same modes. Well, it can not, mm-hmm. not be there for.
Well, let's say. Yeah. So. At higher temperatures, you know, above the dimerization temperature, you won't be able to see it with Raman. Right? It is not a symmetry of your lattice. But below, I mean, in Raman, they do see multitude of extra peaks below, and I have to go back and look if this peak is there. Yeah.
So it's Raman, but you cannot neglect the Q.
Yeah. So yeah, with inelastic X-ray scattering, we have Q dependence that Raman doesn't have.
Sure, but
yeah.
you can be at the Vreeland zone for Raman.
Well, you're always at the zone center at Q equals zero. But if you double the unit cell, then that's the new Q equals
right.
the new zone center.
Yeah. It's not going really to zero there. Mm-hmm. Isn't the phonon really going to zero?
So we can't follow at low temperatures the phonon out to the zone boundary. We don't have good enough signal yet. So this kind of dotted line is what we might expect to see at low temperatures. But yeah, we haven't really followed what's a phonon doing at very low energies at low temperatures. There's more work to be done.
Can you elaborate on how you extract spin phonon coupling?
So that. If you just fit the zone boundary phonon line width with the Krauss-Fischer function, the adjustable parameter there is the spin phonon coupling. So you can extract that just from these fits. It doesn't tell you anything about J. To get J, you have to fit the Q dependence of the phonon line widths away from the zone boundary.
Suggest you know J, right? So in energetic units, what would be the value of the spin phonon coupling?
Yeah. I have that in our preprint. It's not in dimensionless units, so yeah, we can talk about that specifically. But we do have a value for that.
Let's continue because there are a few talks.
Yeah, so let's. Please talk more if you're interested in this. So let me summarize this part and move on. All right, so this is a new spin parallel system. It has a very relatively simple crystal structure, so hopefully it's amenable to theory calculations. We see some interesting lattice distortions below these two transition temperatures, and we also see the soft phonon for the first time, and it'd be great to understand the phonon broadening at a more quantitative level that goes beyond Krauss and Fischer. Okay, let's go to two dimensions. So in two dimensions, we've been very interested in looking for novel ground states, such as the quantum liquid state, where you don't break conventional symmetries like translational symmetry or spin rotational symmetry. And looking at two-dimensional frustrated systems is good because that reduces the tendency for magnetic ordering that you would have on, say, a square lattice. So there's been work on triangular lattices, and we've been focusing on the Kagome lattice arrangement. Let me just differentiate the triangular lattice from the Kagome lattice a little bit. The triangular lattice is an edge-sharing network. So for Heisenberg Hamiltonian, a ground state for a single triangle is to have a 120-degree spin arrangement for each spin on the vertices. And once you do that for one triangle, the neighboring triangle, since it shares two common vertices, that spin is fixed. All right, so once you choose a particular set of spins for the sublattices on one triangle, that constrains the entire lattice. The corner-sharing lattice is different. You only share a single vertex between neighboring triangles. So if I pattern the spins in this way on the top, I can put blue and green this way on the bottom, or put green and blue that way on the bottom. They're both energetically equivalent, so you can see that you can get a much higher degree of degeneracy. Another way of talking about this is if you do choose a particular ground state, you have to break two types of symmetries, obviously the spin rotational symmetry for sublattice, but also the vector chirality, and it's defined in the following way for the three spins on a triangle. And essentially, it's if you go around clockwise from vertex to vertex, do the spins rotate clockwise or do they rotate counterclockwise? If they rotate clockwise, I put a plus in the middle. If they rotate counterclockwise, I put a minus. So it turns out on the triangular lattice, you must have a staggered chirality pattern for the low energy ground state. The Kagome lattice does not have that constraint. There are many possible chiral patterns, such as plus, 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 as drawn here, but you could have minus, 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 or plus, minus, plus, minus. So you actually have an extensively large entropy for the ground state, which is very unusual. And that's because of this very frustrated geometry for the Kagome lattice. So what's the consequence of this highly frustrated geometry? Well, something that you might see is in the spin excitations. And you normally expect for an anti-ferromagnet to have linearly dispersive spin wave modes from the zone center, as shown here in red. But due to the frustrated geometry of the Kagome lattice, there's predicted to be a dispersionless mode shown here in blue, and this was some early work by Brooks Harris and co-workers. And just a visualization of this, so here's an animation. If you take this up direction defined by this top spin of the triangle, then you can rotate the two spins on the that share that triangle in opposite senses. So one spin rotates out of the plane, one spin rotates into the plane, and that preserves the 120 degree arrangement. So every frame of this animation is another spin configuration that has the same energy. And because there's only the single vertex linking this chain to the chain above or the chain below, these spins don't have to be perturbed at all. You know, or you could perturb them and create some arbitrary wavelength rearrangement in this up direction. And you can see that there are chains along these other directions here, and there are chains running along this way as well. So that tells us that you can have different wave vector rearrangements of the spins that don't change the ground state energy. And that's just intuitively what the zero energy mode is. So this is one of the hallmarks of a highly frustrated spin system, and we wanted to do a direct measurement of this.
Second neighbor interactions would lift that degeneracy.
Exactly, yeah. So second neighbor interactions on the Kagome lattice are not frustrated, and we'll see the effects of that. So we studied iron gerasite. It's a mineral, and iron is the magnetic ion, and they form very nice Kagome sheets. This is an iron in the spin half or five halves configuration, so it's large spin, closer to the classical limit. And if you measure the Curie-Weiss behavior, you get a Curie-Weiss temperature of about 800 Kelvin. There is some coupling between the layers that eventually drives a three-dimensional nail order below 65 Kelvin. But that ratio is quite large, and that's, you know, some sense of that this is a highly frustrated system. Another nice thing is that these were grown by my chemistry colleague in this hydrothermal method. They can be grown stoichiometrically pure, which is nice. You have essentially 100% occupancy of the magnetic sites, and especially single crystals can be made, which was a real breakthrough. Here's an example of a single crystal. It's about a centimeter across. We studied this with the triple axis neutron scattering technique. Many of you are probably familiar with this. You just scatter the neutron off of three crystals, one of them being your sample, and you can change the momentum transfer and energy transfer to your sample, and so you can measure what we call the dynamic structure factor, and it's the Fourier transform of the spin-spin correlation function. So before showing you some data, we don't have a perfect Heisenberg-Hamiltonian in real systems. You would expect at least some spin anisotropy, and we can see how would spin anisotropy affect the spin wave dispersions. You can imagine an easy plane term, an XY-like anisotropy, and an Ising term, and this Ising term rotates depending on which magnetic site that you're at. And if you have these two terms, well, you change the dispersions in the following way. And the main thing I want to concentrate on is what happens to the blue mode. So the blue mode was the zero energy mode, but now the blue mode, you wanted to rotate around the spin direction of one of the spins. Now you have to overcome this out-of-plane energy cost. So that lifts the zero energy mode to some finite energy, but it remains flat. If that's all there is, you would still expect a very flat mode that does not go up to the high zone boundary energy. Okay, well, I will get into that. So what gives you the spin anisotropy? We believe it's primarily from the Dowling-Schimberia interaction. And if you look at the crystal structure, so the red are the irons, the blue are bridging oxygens, and it's a buckled bond. You don't have a center of symmetry between the magnetic ions, and it's buckled in the in-plane direction and in the out-of-plane direction as well. So you would expect a Dowling-Schimberia interaction, and you would have components, an in-plane component, which I call dy, and then an out-of-plane component, dz. And you could also have further neighbor interactions as shown here as well. So the dz, so the Dowling-Schimberia vector perpendicular to the Kagome plane, well, that likes to have the two spins perpendicular to that direction, so that would want to have the spins coplanar and give you an XY-like anisotropy. It also would prefer a specific sense for the two spins, you know, particular chirality. If you have a dy component, well, this can give you an Ising-like anisotropy and also cant the spins out of the plane. You don't want all of your spins to be perfectly coplanar. And that can give you a weak ferromagnetism, and very similar to what has been seen in lanthanum copper oxide, which I know many of you are familiar with.
You reject the notion of single ion anisotropy.
I think this is the dominant anisotropy. One thing is that this is a D5 configuration. It's very spherically symmetric, so single ion would be very weak. So I think this is more important. But we can fit our data with both Dowling-Schimberia and single ion and get results that are both plausible. So here's some of our inelastic neutron scattering data. We can fit all of the modes that we see with just four parameters, J, the Dowling-Schimberia vectors, and the second neighbor interaction. And here's a zone boundary position. When we scan energy, we see two modes, and those are the gaps at the zone center. And here's an interesting mode. This is another zone center position, and we go out to the zone boundary. We see that this mode has not shifted very much. There is a small dispersion to it. And here's a summary of our data. We see. These are the spin waves at low temperature.
The ordering pattern is the one you showed with all pluses.
It's the Q equals zero. Yeah, all plus magnetic ordering pattern. Yeah. So this is in at low temperatures in the 3D ordered state. So here is now the lifted zero energy mode shown in blue, and that was very exciting for us to observe. And we do see it's not completely flat. There is a small dispersion to it, and as mentioned before, that tells us that there is a next nearest neighbor interaction, and that's small compared to the nearest neighbor interaction, but we can quantify that. We also know it's sine. And from the gaps at the zone center, we can get the Dowling-Schimberia interactions, and all these lines are spin wave theory calculations done in collaboration with Brooks, Harris, and Tanner Yildirim. So we have a very well-characterized, highly frustrated system.
But is it ended up being easy access, easy handling, or?
So this is, so we can, so this, the lines here are just if you have Dowling-Schimberia, no easy ion anisotropy. You can go to the, no single ion anisotropy.
But you had, okay, which was it that gives you easy plane? Was it DZ? Sorry, I just.
Yeah, so DZ gives you the easy plane.
Even if it's negative, right?
Yes. Yeah. With either sign, you would get easy plane. This particular value gives us the Q equals zero. It favors the Q equals zero configuration with all positive chirality for each triangle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, this sign is how you it's part of the definition of how we define the Dowling-Schimberia interaction.
Your line widths, they are significantly different between the lines. Is it meaningful or different?
So, for example, most of the line widths here are just given by the convolution with the resolution. I think some of the line widths, I believe, are a little bit broader than just delta function spin waves, and we haven't studied that too much in detail. It's not a huge effect. They're very sharp modes. All right. And to go a little bit further, we do think DM is the primary interaction. That gives us a specific canting of the spins out of the plane. And we do see a field-induced transition when we apply a large enough field. Here's a function of field, the magnetization. We see a jump in the magnetization. And we think that what we have is that we have a canting of moments. And at low fields, the neighboring planes are in opposite canted directions. At high fields, you flip all the spins in one layer to gain the Zeeman energy, and that corresponds to the jump in the moment. And from that, you can estimate what is the interplane interaction. So there's this energy competition between the Zeeman energy and the preferred interlayer interaction, and we can get a J perp that's very small, several hundred times smaller than the main in-plane interaction. We can also look at the critical scattering above the ordered phase, above Tn. And with this dz vector, we do expect there to be xy-like fluctuations. And what we see is the following. So here's some raw data. These are spin fluctuations in reciprocal space. We see high intensity at certain zone center positions. And we can model this with short-range fluctuations that have uniform chirality or staggered chirality. And this uniform chirality model seems to work well. So in each correlated region, we do have a uniform chirality, all plus and all minus. And it's not too surprising because the DM interaction likes to select that. What we also see in the intensity is that the different spin directions in the plane are all equally preferred. So that symmetry is not yet broken above Tn. So we're at 70 Kelvin, the ordering temperature 65 Kelvin. So you can have some vector chiral order without breaking spin rotational symmetry. So this could be just ordered because it's broken already by Dallas and Skimmeria. It's not spontaneously broken. And we've done some more measurements of the critical scattering. We can do what we call two-axis, or it's energy-integrated measurements of the spin fluctuations, and that gives us the instantaneous spin correlation length. And that's plotted here as a function of temperature. And we can fit this temperature dependence in different ways. One is just a simple power law. It gives us the exponent nu of about 0.7. Not sure exactly what that means. In this dotted line, it's the Kosterlitz-Thallus prediction. So we do think we have planar spin fluctuations. And that would give us a Kosterlitz-Thallus temperature of about 60 Kelvin, which is below the 3D ordering temperature. So one scenario that we're playing with is that we have a Kosterlitz-Thallus transition for the critical scattering, and it's preempted by the 3D ordering. So you get a longer and longer correlation length, and eventually the 3D ordering kicks in. When we look at some of the thermodynamics in field, so this is applying a field perpendicular to the Kagome plane, we see the following in the susceptibility and the specific heat. At low fields, we see a sharp cusp at where the 3D ordering temperature is. At higher fields, again, you know, we had this field-induced transition, so we don't see the sharp cusp. We see a dramatic downturn once the critical field becomes larger than the field that we can experimentally put. And then that has a drop in the susceptibility corresponding to opposite canting on neighboring planes. But the thing I want to point out is the specific heat in zero field and high field. In zero field, we have a sharp cusp in the specific heat, which becomes much more rounded when we apply a large field. And that's kind of puzzling to us. We don't quite understand what's going on. One possibility is you might have a more two-dimensional type of ordering, which would be more rounded. Or there's another possibility that I've heard that you no longer have a spontaneously broken symmetry once you apply this large field. And that could also give you just crossover behavior. So any ideas about that would be interesting.
Reducing the interplane coupling?
Yeah, so there is, again, the competition between the interplane coupling and then the Zeeman energy. So right at the balancing of the two energies, you can imagine it's decoupled. Yeah. So we have some experiments in mind to test that possibility.
Already experimented with solid liquids, you mix this spaces coming from the
Even above TC, because you have Dalaschinsky-Maria interaction, there's, I think, only one more degree of freedom that's not broken. But once you apply the magnetic field, that's no longer the case. So this is always perpendicular to the Kagome sheet. It does not, but it selects the preferred. You can think of the canting, or there's a scalar chirality that's associated with the canting, and that it selects a particular sign for that.
They're still free to select.
They are still free in the plane, but dy, the in-plane component of Dalaschinsky-Maria, does break eventually that in-plane direction. Yeah, not yet. We don't have that. All right, let me move on. So we also went from a large spin system to a smaller spin system, spin 1/2, and it's very interesting to study this. We're more in the quantum limit. This work has been done, again, this is Dan Ocera's group at MIT, where they made these minerals that have copper on the Kagome lattice sites. And here's a projection of the Kagome lattice site. The blue are the coppers. But you do have, between the Kagome lattice layers, another metal site, which could also be copper. But you could also imagine putting a non-magnetic element there as well. So if you do have, in this case, copper on all the sites, then you do have a more three-dimensional network of coppers. This is called clinoadichamite, and it also is distorted. So it's not, you don't have perfect Kagome layers and triangular layers. This has been studied previously by this Japanese group with μSR, and what they find is that below 18 Kelvin, they believe there's a magnetic ordering transition. They see this from the muon spin rotation, the spin precession, and then below 6 Kelvin, they see some loss of the precession and then the precession coming back again. With neutrons on the same material, we only have powder samples. We've looked and we saw Bragg peaks that are associated with the ordering below 6 Kelvin around here. We don't see this higher temperature transition, and that's still a big puzzle to us. Normally, μSR and neutrons are very complementary. We're not sure how to reconcile this. There might be some ordering transition here that's maybe highly two-dimensional, maybe incommensurate, and it'd be hard to see that with powder neutron diffraction. And then it orders into a different type of configuration below 6 Kelvin, which is more three-dimensional, and we do see Bragg peaks associated with that. But if we want to study the two-dimensional system, well, we can take this clinoadichamite system and replace all these triangular layers of coppers with non-magnetic zinc. And it's a crystallographically distinct position, so you can target that for replacement, and this has been done. One nice thing is once you put zinc in these in-between layers, the Kagome structure becomes less distorted. And it's actually the ideal symmetry for the Kagome structure. When we compare the two different systems, here was the 3D clinoadichamite, here's the zinc system. We no longer see the Bragg peaks at low temperature, which is a good sign because we don't expect the Kagome lattice spin 1/2 system to be magnetically ordered. And we have some results recently published. So if we do have this system, what do we expect when we make measurements? Well, the theoretical understanding is still incomplete, but there's a lot of work going on now, and many of you in the audience are working on this. The general consensus years ago was that it's clearly not supposed to be nail ordered. But what type of ground state do you have? A nice possibility that's very exotic is having a spin liquid ground state. But there are many types of spin liquids. You could have a gap spin liquid, a gapless spin liquid, and here is some early work. This was very famous work for a while on exact diagonalization measurements or calculations, indicating that you might have a spin gap at most of J over 20. And there was some more recent work by Patrick Lee and co-workers. They find a variational ground state that's very competitive in energy that's described by gapless Dirac fermions. That's a very interesting state as well. Another possibility, more conventional, would be if you have a valence bond crystal state, you just have singlets that do break translational symmetry. This was work by Sentel and co-workers, and the dark bonds here are just the singlets, and they kind of form these benzene ring-like configurations. And there was some recent work by Singh and Hughes that kind of saw similar competitive ground states. So just measuring some of the bulk properties of our system, the magnetic susceptibility, here's some of the data as a function of temperature. Obviously, compared to a non-interacting spin a half system shown by the dotted line, our data are vastly different, and that indicates that we do have strong interactions. If you plot the inverse susceptibility as a function of temperature, we get a nice Curie-Weiss fit with the Curie-Weiss temperature of 300 Kelvin. We estimate that gives us a 17 millivolt J interaction. However, all our measurements that go down to 50 millikelvin do not show a transition to a magnetic order. And some calculations that's more detailed by Mizgich and Singh also estimate J of about 190 Kelvin from our susceptibility data. There has been MuSR measurements by Mendels and co-workers and Ofer and co-workers that also confirm that there's a lack of magnetic ordering or spin freezing down to the lowest measured temperatures. So that's very interesting. You know, we know what it's not. We don't have magnetically ordered ground state.
Can I ask a nice question?
Yep.
So could zinc be substituting copper on the cargomain?
It's not as happy on this site. You know, this site is Yontelar active, so copper would prefer to be there. But there might be some small amount of zinc. So this is a question that we're still trying to understand. What small amount of impurities exist in these samples? And there are several groups who have been making these materials, and there could be some impurity contribution. I'll say a little bit more about that. We've measured the specific heat, and this is just the raw data that includes both the magnetic and lattice contributions. And at low temperatures and at low fields, we see this specific heat shown, so it's kind of hidden here. But as a function of field, we see the specific heat does change, and it shifts to higher temperatures. But at the lowest temperatures that we measure, you know, most of this is magnetic in origin. The lattice contribution is not very significant below 1 Kelvin. And what we see at these low temperatures is something that is maybe linear in temperature or sublinear in temperature. And you know, that may be interesting, but the question of impurities, how that affects this, is of course going to be important to understand. At higher temperatures, people have thought that there should be a T-squared dependence. At least that's seen in a lot of two-dimensional frustrated materials. And you know, we can't rule that out. So plotting C over T versus temperature, there might be a roughly linear regime around 20 Kelvin or higher. So that could be T-squared. So understanding what is the magnetic part, you know, trying to subtract the lattice contribution to the specific heat is difficult, and that kind of makes this T-square dependence not clear at the moment.
So this drop on the right-hand side, it still contains lattice contribution?
Yes.
And what's the Debye energy for this?
Not sure. 50 Kelvin, 100 Kelvin. So, yeah, it's going to be hard to really disentangle this. Normally, what experimentalists can do is find a non-magnetic isomorph and study that, but we don't have such a system, unfortunately. All right. In inelastic neutron scattering, again, we have a powder sample that we studied. We measured the dynamical susceptibility down to low temperatures, and just showing a very low temperature, 35 millikelvin data, we see that chi double prime, it always increases as we go down in energy. Now, if you had a spin gap, you would see a drop in the intensity. So we don't see an observable spin gap, at least down to the energies that we measured. So if a gap exists, it's less than about 0.1 millivolts. And that's very small compared to J over 170. We can also measure the Q dependence of the scattering, and you know, we don't have a lot of statistics, but you know, it's very broad in Q, so there's no preferred wave vector for, let's say, if you had singlets. You know, it's not just a single nearest neighbor singlet type of pattern. There's many Qs that are represented. When we apply a magnetic field, we clearly see a shift in the scattering from low energies to some higher energy, a shift in the spectral weight. One thing is that this again tells us that most of the scattering at low energies that we see, consistent with this, is magnetic in origin, because that's always an issue with neutron scattering, identifying the background. And another thing that we see, and I'll say a little bit more about, is that this peak at high fields is not a sharp resolution limited peak in energy. If you had, say, just free spin impurities that give you a peak at the Zeeman energy.
What would standard collection of impurity spins look like in these kind of measurements?
If you had free spin impurities?
Yeah, I mean, dilute, so weakly interacting.
So, yeah, weakly interacting, it's possible that it could contribute to something like this. It's hard, you know, to just say generically weakly interacting impurity system, how that would look, but it's possible it could give you similar behavior to this.
The weak interacting form of spin? But how about orientation dependence of the field?
We don't have information on that. Only powder samples have been made. So looking at all of our data, there is signatures for low energy and low energy scale. Here are some AC susceptibility measurements down to low temperatures. And what we see is a function of field. We see a peak at around 2 Tesla. So if you just plotted the magnetization, you would see a slight step up in the magnetization at 2 Tesla. But this disappears once you go to about 0.7 Kelvin. The specific heat I showed you already, but you can see that there are significant changes in the specific heat. You know, once you go to 2 Tesla and higher, again the same field scale. And this peak in the inelastic neutron scattering, it's not resolution limited. It has a width of about 0.2 millivolts. And again, that's roughly the same energy scale as this 2 Tesla magnetic energy scale. And that's roughly J over 100. So there looks like there is a low energy scale, you know, maybe weakly interacting impurities, maybe something else like Dalachin schemaria. Yeah.
Can one also explore the energy scale of J itself? Or is it too high for neutrons?
So we tried to do measurements at higher energies, but one thing is, you know, the scattering is very featureless in energy. So it's hard to distinguish featureless intrinsic scattering from background. So that's very difficult at the present time. If we could do high signal polarized neutron measurements, we could distinguish the intrinsic scattering. But we just don't have the flux yet. Hopefully the SNS will allow us to do measurements like that. So here are some possibilities for the low energy physics. One is, as mentioned, small fraction of impurities. And this was some work done by Gregoire Mizgich and collaborators. They fit our susceptibility after subtracting 3.7% weakly interacting impurities, and then they can fit the remaining susceptibility to their calculations, and it seems to work quite nicely. And this is work by Singh and coworkers, where they just have a Dalachin schemaria interaction without impurities, and they can try to fit the upturn in susceptibility, and they require Dalachin schemaria vector mostly in plane, which is about 25% of J. And it might be large. I'll remind you, in iron gerasite, we had something on the order of 10% of J, and there are similar buckling for the metal-oxygen metal in this copper system. So getting something on the order of 10% of J is very plausible. Yeah, 25% might be on the high side.
So let me just make sure, William, in the susceptibility
looked pretty strange, right? At low temperatures, it was looking very thermodynamic.
Well, it was increasing like a Curie law at low temperatures.
When the original time to minus one versus temperature, when you, you know, way back.
Yeah.
That's Curie-like down there. That really fits Curie.
Yeah. This is a Curie-like behavior. We can fit it to 5%, 5 or 6%.
Oh, I see. So that's if you subtract it out, you think you believe in the physics.
All right. So the details of subtracting that are very difficult. Yeah. I don't know if that will hit a
really
finite.
What's your guess? Is that impurities?
I think both a small amount of impurities and Dalaschine schemeria are involved. Yeah.
What kind of logic can distinguish them? So this is what Mendel's group did. Take out or give you an idea.
NMR is actually, yeah, what fraction of that is. Yeah. Has that been
That's
done?
Been done, yeah.
Yeah.
How much of that
yeah,
is?
Yeah, so there's been some work.
One tenth of the J for dynamic schemoria order the system activity.
For dy? Right, but which component of the Dalaschine schemeria is important?
So it's a little by Pythagorean.
Yeah, they have like a finite susceptibility at t equals zero, I believe. Yeah. Yeah, it's not published yet, but yeah, I've heard his talk just a few weeks ago.
If this would be all due to impurities, how much of impurities you would need?
About 5%.
5%.
Yeah. All right. So let me summarize the 2D part. The 3D part will be very quick. So in two dimensions, we studied frustrated spins on the Kagome lattice. We've made a lot of progress in understanding this classical spin system where we can have nice single crystals and we understand the interactions that are important. We've made some progress on a quantum spin system where we see that you don't have a conventional ground state, at least down to 50 millikelvin. There's evidence for some low energy scale. Maybe there's impurities that are important, also Dalaschine schemeria. Working on single crystals would help clear up a lot of this, and that's one area that we're feverishly working.
What are the prospects there?
Prospects, I think it'll happen eventually. We have crystals that are visible, but barely, like 10th of a millimeter length scale. But at least that is something that we can build upon. Yeah. All right. On powder samples, I guess. Yeah, it's not my specialty. I don't know who has done it yet. Okay.
For the two magnum peaks, or
would you see what it is? I suspect it is in the spin equilibrium. If we have magnum peaks, you may add variables.
So the last thing I want to say quickly is that in three dimensions, we did some single crystal work on a pyrochlore system, terbium molybdenum oxide, and it's a semiconductor system. Terbium has a large magnetic moment. It's been estimated to be about 9 Bohr magnetons. Molybdenum is spin 1. It's about 2 Bohr magnetons. And the terbium and molybdenum ions form two sets of corner-shearing tetrahedra. So it's kind of complicated system where you'd have both interacting magnetic lattices. But this has been studied previously in powder materials. Early work has been done by Greeden and co-workers in the susceptibility. And what they find is that around 25 Kelvin, you have a divergence in the field-cooled, zero-field-cooled behavior. So you have spin glass behavior without apparent chemical disorder in this system. There's a very similar system where you have yttrium molybdenum oxide, And yttrium here is non-magnetic, so it's mostly the molybdenum that matters. It also has spin glass temperature roughly around the same temperature. So it's believed that you might have similar physics in both, driven by molybdenum. But the nice thing with the terbium system is that you can, neutrons can scatter from this large moment much more readily. So it's some diffuse neutron scattering measurements by Bruce Gollan and co-workers has been performed. And what they see as they cool down in temperature, here's intensity as a function of Q, you see these broad peaks that emerge. And they see that the width doesn't change very much, but the intensity of this diffuse scattering changes as you go into the spin glass state. So,
any actual studies on that? Because I think yttrium and lipdite was supposed to have quite a lot of.
There is some, yeah, disorder perhaps. The terbium system, I don't know if the same studies have been done on terbium. So my postdoc was interested in growing this system, and it's been very difficult. No one has grown these crystals before because molybdenum has a low vapor pressure and it easily evaporates during the process. But we spent a lot of time trying to make this work, and we recently did. So here's some susceptibility measurements on our crystal samples. We see similar behavior as Greed and Saul in the powders, and at below 25 Kelvin, you see the spin glass type freezing. We see another drop below about 5 Kelvin, and we're not sure exactly what's going on there. If you measure the inverse susceptibility, you do have this Curie-Weiss-like behavior, but the Curie-Weiss constant is different than the yttrium system. It's positive. It's indicative of ferromagnetic fluctuations of 12 Kelvin is the Curie-Weiss temperature, and the constant gives us something that's 14 mu B per formula unit, and it's kind of large, so probably the terbium fluctuations are dominating this Curie-Weiss behavior. So this is just some recent data we took at NIST on our single crystal samples. We looked at the diffuse elastic scattering, where it's integrated over some energy range, about 1 millivolt, at low temperatures. And we see this in reciprocal space. We see short range diffuse scattering that's centered at the different Brillouin zone centers, but there is some difference in intensity at the different zone centers, and that will tell us something about the correlations. But the fact that it's centered at the zone centers says that we think this is primarily terbium scattering because it has a large moment. So you have ferromagnetic terbium-terbium correlations. That could be, you know, consistent with the spin ice rules. You do have ferromagnetism. It's believed that the terbium ion does have a finite single ion anisotropy. So maybe you have spin ice, but it's clearly not what you expect from dipolar spin ice, so it might be something different. And one thing that's different is that you do have this molybdenum sublattice that's interacting with the terbium lattice. So how can we describe this? I'd be open to any theoretical help there. And we can also measure the spin correlations along the different directions in the crystal. And what we see if you go along the HH direction is slightly different if you go along the L direction. Here's the integrated intensity. This is consistent with what Bruce Gollan saw in powders. But if you look at the correlations, we do see they actually change a little bit as you cool down in temperature. They increase somewhat. But the magnitude is also different along the different directions. So you do have anisotropic correlation lengths and a weakly temperature-dependent change in the correlations in the spin glass state. And we don't understand exactly what's going on there. So that was just a brief look at some new data that we have, and I'd be very interested in any ideas there. It's a spin glass system. There might be a new transition at low temperatures. How do we model the intensities? Is it spin ice-like? And how do we understand the correlations in the spin glass state? So that's it. Thanks for your attention.
Additional questions? Is there a specific heat measurement for that last compound in the spin glass state?
So we're going to do that soon. I'm thinking of what's been done. I don't remember seeing specific heat measurements in the literature yet.
And what's the spin again for that last gas?
So for terbium, so the best I can do is compare this to materials that have been studied. I think terbium is either in a J equals 4 or J equals 5 state. Okay. Other than the spin one.
So you expect it to be a classical spin loss, or do you think quantum effects are still important there?
I don't know. Yes.
Yeah, coming back to the gyroscope side, the spin 5 half gyroscope side, what is the driving force of the ordering? Is it the DM interaction, J2 quantum fluctuations?
I think it is. I think it's the DM interaction is driving the ordering. So it's making the system coplanar, and then you get increasing correlation lengths, you know, via probably a Kostrov-Salvis transition. And of course, once you get something, you know, tens of unit cells for a correlation length, then you have a large patch that, with even weak coupling between layers, will try to lock in and give you 3D ordering. So the 3D ordering is very weak. It's, you know, a few hundred times smaller than the in-plane, or the 3D interactions are weak, a few hundred times smaller than the in-plane interactions. So I think that's just a marginal part of the ordering transition. It's primarily increasing 2D correlation lengths that drive the transition.
Okay. I'm a little confused about the VM vectors in the Kabumet case. You have a component, presumably the vector V depends on the bond.
It does, yes.
So for each bond you have a different V vector.
Correct. So going along,
you quote, are those per bond or are those already the averages?
The magnitude, absolute magnitudes do not change. Just the sign changes going from bond to bond. So going along this line, for example, DZ is up here, down, where's the line? Yeah, it's kind of hard. All right, going along this line. You know, DZ would be up here, and down here. It changes its direction, but not its magnitude.
Yeah. Now, with this Kabumet structure, I'm not sure what the component in the plane is. What breaks the symmetry in the plane, given the lattice structure you have there?
You have this buckling. I think it's just from the buckle of the oxygen bond.
Yeah, but you have a 60 degree sort of symmetry in the plane, or? What picks the direction?
Coupler's not elastic.
Yes. We're talking about the couplers.
So the in-plane component, the dy, will point toward the center of the triangle for this bond, and for this bond it also points to the center of the triangle. So that dy also rotates depending on which bond you're at.
But it is still the next dy after some demand.
So per bond, there's always a non-zero dy for each bond.
Right, but that would be perpendicular to each bond, and then when you sum up all the bonds, I'm not sure how anything remains.
Well, but that will transfer itself to the plane, right?
Yes.
That's the Z component.
Just a comment about this Hamiltonian. 5 years or so ago, some theorists, I think Matthew Fisher and Rand Downs and others, added additional terms to Hamiltonians, like that ring exchange term. And since part of the theme of your talk was sort of solving for the coefficients of that Hamiltonian from your experimental data, it might be interesting if you put in a ring exchange term slot and look for any evidence that it was there.
That would be interesting.
I mean, it's changed its depth, I think.
Well, I'd love to see the prediction, and then I can compare that to that. It can be calculated.
What will be the number of spins involved in range?
I think it's just that's a bow tie move or something, so they're two spins that get each switched simultaneously or in exchange?
It doesn't hold three spins. It has to hold at least four.
Well, four sites. Right. Yeah, four spins on four sites. So
the ring is not just around a triangle.
No, I think it's called a bow tie.
Does this?
Yes, they're four neighbors four of the neighbors.
The ring change of three spin gives the coupling of the scalar current perpendicular to the plane.
It just gives simple exchange.
No, the coupling of H perpendicular to the triangle plane change as long as we see to the scalar current.
So for spin 1.5, it's just the Heisenberg, no? But for larger spins, it's different. For larger spins, if you make permutation, generate all the coupling.
For larger spins, it becomes very hard to take the root larger spin.
Yeah, it becomes very hard, and the meaning of this just keeping is not just exchange.
Any questions or comments?
What is known about the dependence of the glass aperture on the entropy content and molybdenum compounds or similar compounds, the interior compounds?
Dependence on the glass temperature is a function of what?
You say it's totally pure, but in fact there are some impurities as anyone is trying to
There's been several papers by Mirabeau and co-workers where they intentionally substitute, and they actually get an ordered magnetic state instead of a spin glass state, something like that.
Yeah, this similar ones compound when you are in impurities, you keep the transition goes down.
Yeah, I don't know if they've done very.
But do they see a stronger distortion than basic? Because it's just not absolutely easy to record it with this structure.
Yeah. I'm not sure what their substitution measurements show for the structure.
Thank you very much, John. Yeah, it's a good one.